Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Head of the Department of Language and Linguistics at La Trobe University. This is episode CLII, The Roman Empress. We've spent many years telling you about Roman emperors, and always the empress has been there beside him, occasionally in the spotlight, but usually on the sideline. At times we know little more about them than their name, but some were interesting individuals in their own right, wielding real power and influence over Roman society. For the next few episodes, we will be examining the life of some of the most notable Roman empresses, the lives they lead, and the influence they held in the imperial household. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
The role of the empress is a strange one that evolves over time. So we might think of formal roles, monarchical roles, or roles for women in government, like first ladies, as being formalized. So in the US, there have only ever been male presidents and their wives are first ladies. We've had queens, we've had empresses. These are formalized often by a constitution or by habit, by tradition. But say when we're starting with the very first emperor, Augustus, there is no real role for his wife, Livia. In a way, you could say that she helps to create it. So there's no formal position. And really, it's open to whatever the emperor and his wife and his court want to make of that role and how much input she will have. So to a degree, it's kind of intriguing. And that's one of the reasons we're looking at these women, is that it does depend on the individual. One thing is for sure, though, they are very, very close to the seat of power, which from the time of Augustus resides in one man. He has ultimate power, which has never happened before in historical Rome, at least. Not since the time of the kings, which is sort of mythical Rome. What that means is, from the point of view of many of our sources, which come from the senatorial class, this woman has an enormous amount of influence, at the very least influence and authority, because she, in many, many senses, is closest to the most powerful man in their world. So she can make of that role whatever she chooses and whatever the emperor allows.
Right. But it's also depending on, I guess, the amount of power that the Senate has and how amiable they are. And I guess conditions in Rome as well. There's a lot that can go into it. While the emperor's power remains relatively stable, it seems that what it means to be an empress and what an empress can do and how they are regarded changes quite a lot. I want to say almost from emperor to emperor, but it's very much down to the individual sometimes, isn't it?
Well, it is about the situation of that reign in a way. How comfortable do the senators feel about their position with a particular emperor? You could say that the way they depict an empress will depend on how they feel about the emperor. Do they feel like they have enough power and respect and authority, or has she trodden on their toes? And it's not just the empress, it's also the other people in the court, like the freedmen. These are all people who traditionally didn't have power in Rome, women and slaves and ex-slaves. And now they surround the emperor so they can have power. And that's the big difference when we come to emperors. So it's not so much what the Senate allows, it's more the way they then go on to represent the empress. So in a failed reign, say where the emperor ends up being murdered, the women are probably not going to be depicted very well. Or a failed reign where the senators feel that the emperor doesn't have full control of himself. They might well say, well, that's because his wife was really in charge. So in a way, the way the empress is depicted is a reflection of attitudes towards the emperor. We shouldn't just think that, you know, it's all down to these senators and the way that their kind of PR campaign for or against an empress. We also have material remains that an empress can leave. So if she builds buildings, in other words, pays for buildings to be built.
Yeah, that happens.
Perhaps puts her name onto them.
Yeah.
She can certainly win favor and popular support in that way.
You got an example on top of your head?
I do. Yeah. So for example, Livia builds a porticus, the Porticus of Livia, which is this, you know, fantastically elaborate colonnaded structure, public building that she kind of gives to the people of Rome. The Empress's position in some ways is more independent than you might think of it, though, because women in Rome in this period are really in some ways more attached to their father's family than they are to their husband's.
Mm.
And this is not just empresses. In a way, you can think of Roman women of the late Republican and early imperial period as more independent than you might expect in a patriarchal society, because they never really fully move into their husband's household. So they don't belong to them in the way we might think of 19th century British women, who are pretty much the property of their husbands. And we can see this with the first empress, Livia, who, when Augustus dies in 14 CE, he adopts her, right? Which is weird to think of a husband adopting a wife. But the reason he does that is by being part of his family, which of course is the most important family in Rome now, she gets that authority, which as his wife, she doesn't really have. Making her his daughter means that she gets property rights, she gets rights in his will, she gets his name, and as I say, she gets a lot more authority than if she had only, and in quotation marks, only been his wife.
Mm, okay. And I guess with any of these things in Rome, the first one is the most important one to happen because that sets the precedent. An emperor, an empress can refer back to saying, oh, look, Livia got this, for example. Therefore, it's not really going to make things difficult if I get it as well.
Yeah, the precedent is really important and nowhere more so than in Rome, again, as a generalization.
Mm.
Being a very legalistic society and one also bound up in tradition, if they can point to a precedent, then that makes a strong case for it happening again.
Yeah.
At the same time, any negative ideas we have about Livia, and my goodness, there are plenty of them from people like Tacitus, people could be seen as setting themselves in stark relief compared to her, maybe just not showing themselves as being quite as powerful or independent as she is.
Maybe not poisoning quite so many people.
That's just a rumour. Enough of that. You've been watching I, Claudius, too much.
I have been. I'll try not to to let that hand out too much. Okay, so let's pull it back a step and just talk for a moment on what qualities made a good Roman wife to a Roman and the place that they held in society, because the role of an empress, I guess, is built on a woman's place in Rome.
Exactly. And a woman's place in the family in particular,
mm.
because they are the imperial family. They are dynastic. So the most important quality, certainly we get this impression both from literature and particularly from tombstones, for a Roman woman is chastity.
Right.
All right. So pudicitia in Latin. Faithfulness, which is also rolled up in that, being faithful to your husband, being a good mother, particularly involved with the education of your children.
Mm.
And if you're an elite woman, then, well, if you're an elite woman, you do come from a good family, I guess, but the husband's family will be measuring up whether this is a good match, either in terms of money or family. Is it a patrician family or family that has had a lot of consuls, or has maybe someone in her family has celebrated a triumph? So what kind of respect and dignity and honor are they going to get from that family?
Mm.
And of course, the woman's father will be looking for similar attributes in the husband. So this is not just something that's attached to desirable wives. You want to have a wife who is dutiful. So there is an idea that women should obey their husbands. Certainly that they shouldn't set themselves above their husbands. But again, because the woman does retain some fidelity to her father and some fidelity to that family, it's not quite in the way we might think of as total duty to the husband. Because one thing we should remember is that divorce is very easy in Roman society and happened a lot amongst the elites. If the father decides that he can make a better match for his daughter, which will do well for his family, then he might well decide to withdraw her from that family and match her up with someone else.
In that instance, which does happen quite a lot, the name that you bring with yourself kind of trumps everything else as far as dutifulness, chastity, and those kind of desirable qualities.
By name there, you mean the family name, not
yes.
reputation.
Yes.
Although they're tied together, of course.
Yeah, they are. But, you know, you will take somebody with a bad reputation if they've got a good name.
So, yeah, the reputation of the family that she comes from is most important, where you can trace back that family. Remember that the woman doesn't change her name.
Mm.
Her name is her father's name. And that doesn't change unless, like Livia, she gets adopted in her husband's will.
Yes.
So she always belongs more to that family. And in a way, the imperial family is going to do something strange with this because they will then be the family that everyone wants to aspire to be part of. And therefore, if you marry into the imperial family, it probably isn't quite like that anymore. So they're sort of changing that dynamic, right? If you're married to an emperor, then if you betray him, it's not just a matter of divorce and maybe some kind of punishment, depending on where you are and what the law is.
Mm.
It could be seen as treason. So it is a bit different for empresses because they are attached to such an important family.
Okay.
So there's a kind of a tension going on there between what most Roman women can expect and what empresses can expect. Their allegiances are a little bit shifted.
They're also really kind of held up as you need to be an example to others.
Very much as role models.
Yes.
And so they will be celebrated for that chastity and duty and for their kind of domestic goddess status.
Mm.
I shouldn't use words like goddess when we're talking about Rome because some of them did actually become goddesses. But we see it there again with Livia. She's such a good example, such a good paradigm in many ways that Suetonius tells us that she and the other women of Augustus's household made his clothing for him. So they're weaving.
Mm.
They're doing what might be seen as quite a lowly task, but it is a woman's task within the household. It's the task of the matrona, the mother, respectable Roman mother, to make the clothing. There's all kind of messages buried in there, like, you know, Augustus, at least on the surface, aspired to be humble, and so he's taking his family along with that, and Livia is part of that. But also that she fits into this pattern of domesticity and a paradigm for an example of what women should be like. It's also important with Livia and subsequent empresses that they actually get shown in public. So there are statues of them, there are depictions of them in ways that Roman women really weren't before we get to empresses, or not very often. And so it's not just what's said about them, it's being able to see them. And, you know, when they're depicted, they will be depicted as veiled with, you know, clothing that covers their whole body. So very discreet, very chaste. And that's part of the message.
So can you tell me about the different titles that an empress was awarded and go through the context that they would have come up in?
So the emperor himself has loads and loads of titles eventually, and a lot of them are taken over from roles from the Republican era. So, you know, Augustus is princeps, the first man, which is a role from the Republic. There are no titles for women in the Republican system. So they kind of get invented. The biggest one, I guess, is Augusta. So the female version of Augustus, which is what Livia gets when Augustus dies. So technically she doesn't get it till then. And that means she is a member of that family. Just like Augustus and Caesar, Caesar become part of the emperor's titles, it becomes part of the empress's title.
Mm-hmm.
So Augusta is the one that will be maintained. She will also sometimes get the equivalent of pater patriae, the father of the fatherland, mater patriae. Not always, but you can see that makes sense. And again, it fits into this idea that the imperial family is kind of, they're the father and mother of all of Rome. Sometimes they will get the title Mater Castrorum, so the mother of the camp, which is to do with the emperor's military presence and his military titles.
Mm.
That's something that would fit, especially if she's an empress who goes on campaign with the emperor, or sometimes it might become honorific. This seems to be something we get particularly later with empresses like Julia Domna.
Yeah, she does accompany Septimius Severus around, doesn't she?
And you can imagine if, this is a bit of a what if, but if Caligula's father, Germanicus, had become emperor, as at one point he was lined up to be, then his wife, Agrippina,
may have got that name.
Yeah, she had travelled around with him.
She'd
on
at
his
least
campaign
qualified
in
for it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There are other titles, things like Pia Felix Augusta, again, Julia Domna gets, which is the pious, blessed. It's an addition to the Augusta title, the wife of Augustus. And after she dies, of course, if it's been a popular reign, she might become Dea. She might become goddess.
That isn't something that happens as often as the emperor being deified, is it?
No, and you can see that it is controversial from the beginning. In fact, deification is always slightly controversial.
Mm.
So the first empress to qualify is Livia, but it does not happen for a long time.
Is that the reign of Claudius that happens
in? Yeah, it does. And he's her grandson. But when she dies in 29, there's sort of an expectation. For example, Ovid in his poetry, and he died a decade earlier, he had been sort of looking forward to the deification of Augustus and implying that it would happen to Livia too. So it was clearly talked about.
Yeah.
And is talked about again when she dies, and Tiberius, 15 years into his reign, not interested.
Wow, mother
Even
issues.
Well, that's the way that it is interpreted, certainly by both ancient and a lot of modern commentators. And it may be that he did not think that women should be raised to these heights. It may have been those mother issues.
Mm.
One of the things it would have done for him is made him, he's already the son of a god. He could now be the son of a goddess. He doesn't seem interested in that. So maybe there's some modesty going on there, if you want to be nice to Tiberius.
There's a lot he wasn't interested in, I think, about being emperor.
It's true. It is true, yeah. He's kind of hiding away by then. Caligula could have done it. He's the great-grandson of Livia. But it's Claudius who does it.
Mm.
He becomes emperor in 41. So, 12 years later.
12 years later. Okay. Quite a noticeable amount of time.
Yeah.
But she's still in living memory and clearly fondly remembered if he thinks there's still currency in doing that.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it doesn't happen with other empresses. They generally get either deified straight away or not at all.
Mm.
And to a certain extent, they are, as in all things, a little bit reliant on how popular their husband's reign was.
Yes, yes.
So when we get to the second century, particularly the reign of Hadrian, Hadrian starts handing out deifications like they're sort of tokens.
Yeah.
And doing it for his mother-in-law and almost any woman in his family. Also for his boy love. So I don't know whether you think that cheapens it. It becomes much more regular by that point. And it's happened to his adopted mother as well, Plotina. Second century, I would say it becomes the norm. Mm-hmm. Unless the emperor has been murdered, that his wife will be deified.
So how much independence would a Roman empress have had? I mean here both in, I guess, what they're doing in their everyday lives and also the decisions and maybe a bit of the influence that they have?
Well, within the restrictions that they have, so, you know, if they go out and have numerous affairs, when that gets found out, not good. Not good outcome for them.
Sure.
So if you're talking about complete independence about what you do, deciding to divorce the emperor, that kind of thing, probably not so much. But if we're talking more about actions within the household, technically, the mother of the household makes decisions within the household, and they are in the imperial household. So they get to direct a lot of what goes on domestically. And that, of course, does include the education of presumably the heir who will live in the household too.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are actually his mother or often his adopted mother with adopted emperors, then they might well be in charge of his upbringing or his welfare. They also have control over a lot of the household staff. So they will be making a lot of really important decisions. The fact that they also, and I've already mentioned this, get to establish, say, state building programs, that implies a lot of decisions and independence going on there.
Mm.
This is not something that empresses invent, because women have been involved in property and business before this. So we know that some elite women in the Roman Republic basically were business women. So this is kind of, again, putting it on the state level in a way that women in the Republic didn't, because they didn't have access to that. So there is more independence and power that comes with that role at a state level. They can do things that become sort of public. So they'll be part of state ceremonies. They'll be part of, you know, the makeover of Rome in Livia's case and in cases of other empresses too. They get to travel a lot, which is not to say that women didn't at all before if they could afford it, again, in a very public capacity. So there is a lot of power associated with being the empress. And in a way, it's only curtailed by what the emperor himself might see fit to do.
Yeah, that's very apparent. We get instances, I guess, of political power and decision-making. So I'm going to use Agrippina here as a bit of an example, but not go into too much detail. So she recalls Seneca from exile to educate her son Nero.
we also get instances of, once Nero becomes emperor, of her having a bit of power actually in the Senate from behind a curtain, albeit.
That is deeply resented, though, as we'll see.
Yes. But I guess, you know, when you get on to later dynasties, this is towards the end of the Severan dynasty, you've got the women having that sort of power as well, yeah, having political power.
That, remember, is more likely to be possible because some of these emperors are very young.
Mm.
So it's often depicted as women being sort of overpowerful and the power behind the throne. But for someone like Agrippina, her son is 17 when he becomes emperor.
Yes.
What does he know?
Yeah.
So it's not surprising that he's just at that point between being a boy and being a man. She has been in charge of him during that time and his education, as you say, bringing Seneca in to take charge of that. Much as Agrippina gets a lot of flack, it's not really surprising that she still sees that as part of her role. And some emperors are very young. Anyway, even if they're not, the fact that they are at that elite position, that they are part of that dynasty and that dynastic framework, means that it's very unlikely that they're going to relinquish that power or need to, because they live with these people, you know, who have ultimate power. So we do get a lot of what is seen as power behind the throne.
Mm.
Absolutely. There are also a lot of accounts of, say, overthrowing emperors where the empress might have been involved.
Mm.
So either overthrowing the previous emperor or even overthrowing her own husband. So like, that is not unknown.
Poisoning mushrooms and...
Yeah, again, rumour.
Yeah. and figs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the stuff with Livia is even more conjecture. Livia poisoning Augustus. But
yeah.
Tacitus seems fairly certain that Agrippina killed Claudius. But also being part of plots to get rid of emperors who die, you know, clearly very violently. It is definitely a plot to overthrow them, like Domitian. There are rumours that empresses were involved. And the other way around, there are also accounts of empresses being involved in what happens next, even if, say, the Emperor Trajan, there's no stories of his wife Plotina plotting against him, but she's very much pro-Hadrian, who's the next emperor, to the extent that there are rumours instead that she had an affair with him. But she is obviously taking part in engineering his succession. She favours him and that helps him. There is even maybe some evidence through coins and inscriptions that Ulpia Severina ruled very briefly in the 3rd century, so in her own right. Ulpia was the wife of the Emperor Aurelian.
So while it's great being the Emperor's wife, inherently, if the Emperor is unpopular, you're in danger as well, aren't you?
Yeah. If the Emperor is caught up in a coup, then, you know, it's the decision of those who overthrow the Emperor whether they spare the wife or not. And in particular, if there's an heir, they may decide not to. In the case of Caligula, who is killed in a really bloody incident, the coup leaders, various hangers-on by that stage, rush into the imperial palace and they kill his wife, his fourth wife. He's not that old, but he's had four wives, called Caesonia, along with their infant daughter, Julia, who's, you know, no more than a toddler.
Right.
It's a really horrible scene.
Yeah.
So there are definitely dangers in being married to somebody like Caligula. I mean, there are dangers if they're overthrown. Of course, there are also dangers if you get pointed out as somebody who has betrayed the emperor. And we'll see there are some empresses who come to a bloody end at the hands of the emperor.
Mm.
So it's a position of prominence. You definitely put your head above the parapet and there will be people out to get you.
Well, it happens as well to mothers of emperors. So the ones that come to mind, again, this is Severan, the mother of Elagabalus, Julia Samoas, is executed along with Elagabalus, and Julia Mamaea, the mother of Severus Alexander, also dies when he is killed. I think that kind of goes with being too close to an unpopular emperor during a regime change.
Yeah. I think it's particularly awful that poor old Caesonia, who wouldn't really have any power after Caligula's gone, and their little baby daughter, who's obviously not going to be an heir because this will go through the male line and he doesn't have a male heir.
Mm.
I mean, not that I'm advocating this, but Octavian gets rid of the son who might have been Caesar's by Cleopatra. Just too much of a danger to have a male rival.
Yes.
But why get rid of Julia? That just seems utter spite. They've just gone crazy. It just seems like this overflow of violence to kill off a baby girl.
So if we were to think about empresses, and this is actually quite an appropriate way to end this episode because I keep leaning on I, Claudius, for the portrayals of women in ancient Rome. And a lot of that has to do with me watching it quite recently. But I, Claudius, isn't alone in this. So if we were to look at empresses and women in Rome through the lens of Hollywood, our most accessible medium, what sort of impression should we take away and how would you like to course correct those?
Right. I feel like Tacitus in particular has a lot to answer for here, maybe via Robert Graves, in that Livia is portrayed by both of them as this utter schemer. She can smile and smile and be a murderer, for sure.
She was a great character.
Fantastic character. Yeah. And apparently the basis for the bitch character in soap operas.
Yeah.
So there's a whole tradition that follows on from her. And it's that idea that a woman in power will be very manipulative. It certainly doesn't start with the TV I, Claudius. It's there in the book as well, of course. But if you look back at films from the 50s and before, but the 50s onwards are probably the easiest ones to get hold of, there are wives like Poppaea, the wife of Nero. Everybody should watch I, Claudius because she's portrayed as this real vamp character. She's sort of flaunting herself all around the court. She wears these really tight dresses. She's really spiteful and not to be trusted, kind of beautiful, but using that beauty in a really vicious way. But actually, there are a lot of films where the Empress is just missing. I think the films that don't want to do that, the Empress or Mother of the Emperor will be dead, or the Emperor might be young and single like Commodus is in Gladiator. But of course, that leaves space for him to lust after his sister, so to show that he's deviant.
Mm.
So we don't necessarily always get an empress. That's kind of as interesting as when we get one, where it's just left as a gap.
So Roman women in film are essentially either scheming, seductress, or so bland that they're not even there. So do you think that there's room in Hollywood for the portrayal of a good Roman heroine as an empress? Do you think that there is the historical context for that sort of thing? Because you wouldn't go for Livia, for example.
Well, you could. You could do a revisionist version after all, couldn't you? I think with the right writing...
I don't want to do that podcast series.
With the right writing, you could do anything, you know, with good writing that looks at the context and tries to, in some ways, read against the grain of some of those sources. Say the way people have with Caligula... This is more in scholarship.
Yeah.
They've tried to say, well, you know, Caligula was dealing with this system that sort of steered him one way. And so he was being ironic when he said, I may as well make my horse a consul. I think you could do similar things with the reputations of some of these empresses. I do think now, actually, I hadn't thought of this before, but just with us discussing it, that's a little bit of what they were trying to do in Gladiator. I don't think they were successful. She's not an empress. She's the sister of an emperor. That they're trying to see how you survive a tyrannical reign. And maybe you could do an empress like that. So you could have a Poppaea, Nero's wife, who actually has a terrible life and is kicked to death by him while she's pregnant.
Right.
Remember that?
That's yeah.
So I don't know if you want to show that bit, but, you know, he has a few wives. You could see them as women who are caught up in a system that they try to negotiate and try to decide should they be on the side of the emperor or not. He has absolute power. Do you feel sorry for him or do you go along with his tyranny if he's a tyrant? So I think there's definitely space for that.
That was Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, head of the Department of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. They are, and let me emphasise, always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us both on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we'll discuss the life of the Roman Empress Messalina. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.